Live from Burbank, California, where all nationalities have easy access to smog. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, his economic presence can be ignored. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim Earle. Thank you. Hope you had a good weekend. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, you lurking conservatives, sulking conservatives, downtrodden, facing down, head downward tilted conservatives. No recourse, no response anymore. There's nothing you can do to defend your positions. But thanks for listening. Maybe you can have a couple laughs and learn something. How would that be? We got quite a show today. We got Roberta Grossman. She's a director of the documentary Homeland, Four Portraits of Native Action, which I watched last night. Very inspiring, very touching. It's about, it's basically four Indian stories of Indian activists from different communities around this country facing different corporate monstrosities, different versions of Manifest Destiny, and fighting them with some effect on the Navajo Nation up in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, also over there in up there in Montana, and also in Penobscot, Maine. It was a good film, and I'm going to be excited to talk to her. Later in the show, we have Scott Ritter, former U.N. weapons inspector, I'm sure many of you know, and author of several books. Very outspoken, always great to talk to him, always sobering, if not grim, but nonetheless, the information is important. I believe in a few minutes, hopefully, we're going to get Jim's big brother, is it? His big brother, John Earle, an activist and union organizer, was out there at down in Santa Ana at one of the protests. You know, hundreds of thousands of people all over the country, mostly Hispanic people and supporters of immigrants' rights, protested today. I just went to the bank, and oddly, I asked a woman at the bank why it was so crowded, but she said seven of her employees didn't show up. Four of them said they weren't going to show up. Apparently, the mode that most businesses are taking is that if they got advance notice, and so be it. But she said three didn't. Obviously, they're not going to get paid. But people here are pretty supportive, even by way of just saying, "Hey, you know what? What are you going to do?" They're not going to penalize these people for expressing their right of dissent out in the streets. And I got to be honest with you. It went much faster for me at the bank. I don't know if everyone was working twice as hard because seven people were gone, but I was in and out very quickly.
Yeah, you know, Heather went out. She said the streets were clear.
Yeah.
So, hey, more of this.
Woo! And then I went to the gas station to fill up my Camry, my four-cylinder Camry, dude. Four-cylinder Camry. My little Camry. I went to fill it up. And I was empty. Guess how much it cost me.
Probably cost you like $12?
$52, man. $52.
I'm out of touch.
To fill up my little Camry with gas, with plus. I put plus in, but $52? Are you kidding me?
That Camry's kind of big. It's not a little car, though.
The silver one? It's a four-cylinder one. The other one's a six-cylinder, the 95. But nonetheless, okay. I mean, I'm not barely driving. Well, that's not true. You can't not drive here. But $52, all of a sudden, I'm thinking different. I'm thinking angry. I'm thinking I was already angry, but there is no way that the gas companies can need that money from me.
You're looking forward to that $100 refund thing that the
what an insult!
You.
What did Bill Frist? That was insulting. Does he think that people are that stupid? What year does he think it is? It's the same with tax credits for working people. $200.
Yeah.
I don't know who the hell they find that say that $200 came in handy in this economy, in this day and age, in America. $200 comes in handy for what? For what? Answer me. For what?
They $200. Well, it depends on where you go with that $200.
I know, but even if you're making
that, lonely, it can help a lot.
$15,000 a year. I mean, I guess $200 makes a difference. Maybe I have a bad perspective. Obviously, it comes in handy if you need it, but it's no incentive to support policy. I can't imagine that $100 would be incentive for somebody to support the Republican agenda. That just seems crazy. Let's talk to your brother because he is out there on the streets with the people. This is Orange County union organizer, activist, Jim Earle's big bullying brother, from what I understand. How are you, John Earle?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So what's the scene down there in Santa Ana? How many people you got out there?
Well, there were about 10,000 at the peak a couple hours ago. Now there's probably still at least half that many around here.
And it's been pretty peaceful and pretty effective? People are out there speaking their minds?
Yeah, it's been very peaceful. There was a little Minuteman contingent out here, about 20 or 30 people. That was probably the most contentious period of time there, but mostly they were ignored.
Were they on
a lot of people out here, mostly waving American flags, some with Mexican flags, talking about workers' rights and immigrant rights.
Were the Minutemen on a flatbed truck with a barbed wire fence built around them?
No, I know they were standing up on something. I forgot what it was, though, but no flatbed truck and no pistols that I know of.
Okay. So let me ask you a couple questions about what we're looking at here, because I know you're a union organizer. And tell me, what is the progressive outlook in terms of what are we supposed to be looking for? What is the best way to handle this? As a union organizer, how do you feel about illegal immigrants and how should they be handled?
Well, we need to realize that so-called illegal immigrants are workers, just like those of us here are workers, regardless of our ethnicity or what side of the artificial border we're on. We need to see this as a workers' rights issue. Both workers on both sides of that artificial border are being had by U.S. corporate imperialism in Mexico that's destroying the economy there and causing the migration northward. So what I'd like to see as an organizer is the peace movement, environmental movement, labor movement, immigrant rights movement joining together on this issue and creating an even bigger demonstration and strike.
And don't you think that it should be the corporations and the businesses that should be penalized for not paying the proper wage to these people?
Well, I think they should be penalized when they violate workers' rights, when they don't pay properly. And I think we need the only way to really deal with that is to make union organizing across the border, internationally, not just in Mexico, easier. So we have one of the most repressive countries in the world here today among modern nations with regards to labor rights and organizing rights. So we violate the International Labor Organization Treaty of the United Nations that we're a part of.
And it
we're way behind the times in terms of our labor rights situation.
And it seems, John Earl, that some of the Mexican unions were supporting the protest today by doing a boycott. Uh-oh.
Hello?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Stop strangling that child.
Yeah, okay, I hear you now.
All right. So, John, it seems that there was some solidarity on behalf of the Mexican unions for this protest today. Is there a movement towards creating a consolidated union along the lines of what is known as the free trade agreement? Is that going to be the next evolution of the trade union movement?
Well, it should be. I think there's obviously a lot of opposition. The problem is that in the American labor movement, a lot of it is so solidly linked to the Democratic Party, which supports NAFTA. And so there's the leadership, the corrupt leadership, and that's kind of sold out long ago, is at odds with the rank and file here in this country and in Mexico. So we'll see what happens.
So in practical solutions, John Earl, what is to be done in terms of at least making sure that you're there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, to at least to make sure that these people, these workers, who are here either illegally or not illegally, well, I mean, primarily, I guess we can still use the term illegally, we should facilitate a process for them to get...
You hear me?
Yeah, I do.
What needs to be done is full legalization with full legal rights. No guest worker program. That's a second-tier work system of indentured servitude. We ought to have full legal rights for those people.
All right, thank you very much, John Earl. Get back to the protest. You take care. All right, that was Jim's brother live, clearly very live.
Man, I wanted to ask him what the hell happened to my bike.
Oh, I'm sorry I didn't get you in there. I was jamming on the questions because...
Yeah, that's all right.
We don't get a committed progressive viewpoint because the other side of that is when you have people like Tom Hartman, this is a difficult issue. And in my gut feeling is, not unlike your brother's, that I think that we should integrate and make these people legal and part of the workforce and pay them properly, and that people should be penalized for, employees should be penalized for not paying them properly because that drives the wage down for everybody. But then I guess the argument on the other side is, well, if they're going to take those jobs at a reasonable working wage, that means that all those Americans that aren't taking them because it isn't a reasonable working wage will want them then and then not be able to have them.
Yeah.
And Tom Hartman and some other progressives say that what they should do is not hire any of them that are illegal and take away the jobs and make them go back because the jobs aren't here and let the Americans that are willing to do those jobs take those jobs. It's a very different set of standards. One is a seemingly American populist point of view in terms of benefiting the American worker, and the other is a progressive point of view in terms of integrating people into this country, because that's what this country was built on, and giving them the proper rights if they are willing to pay taxes and honor the laws of the country.
I would think you can't benefit the American worker unless you benefit all workers, though, and that seems to me like, you know, something that should start in Mexico.
And approaching trade policy in Mexico, because there are a lot of Mexican immigrants that that are not Mexican immigrants, Mexican nationals that were protesting along with the protesters here, and they called it No Gringo Day down there, and they weren't going to go to Walmart or Burger King or McDonald's, and that had some impact on the economy down there, and those are definitely the real criminals,
it's
I believe.
Good for the health, too.
Yeah, it is good for the health, Jim. I seem to have gotten away from the very important topic of a lot happened in the news today. And, of course, we were on it. We had to take that call. So let's get to this now. We here at the Mark Maron Show don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. So here's today's edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. Illegal immigrants and their allies gathered today in cities around the country for a planned National Day of Economic Protest against immigration laws. As a counter-protest, Minutemen militia members built a barbed wire fence. Numerous contractors urged the Minutemen to continue their protests with some roofing and light landscaping. Cash under the table, of course. Unfortunately, the movement suffered a major setback early in the day when comedian Carlos Mencia showed up for work. After a four-hour strategy workshop with international space officials, and scientists, NASA officials said making money on the moon is an essential part of the U.S. plan for space exploration. A spokesman for the Bush administration said they don't care about the money, just make it with the magical moon cheese. Is that right?
Moon cheese.
Yeah. Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards is reportedly recovering from a concussion in a New Zealand hospital after he fell out of a palm tree. Richards said he hadn't felt that close to death since that time he almost fell in the pool while he and Mick were drowning Brian Jones. And that's the short order news for tonight. We're going to get another point of view on the protest from a guy who's been on the show before, a tax accountant and BioWave analyst. Jeff DiCarlo is out on the street, so we'll see what angle he's got in just a second.
And now he's boycotting picante sauce. Mark Maron.
Yeah, that's I don't know who makes that. I think it's made in Texas by the Picante family.
Yes.
I don't know. Hey, folks, we're going to talk a little bit about Stephen Colbert's assault on the president a little later in the show. I thought it was genius. I thought it was great. I thought it took a tremendous amount of nads, as they say, in the game. We're also going to be talking a little bit about the three-year anniversary of Bush standing on that boat saying mission accomplished. We've also got Scott Ritter later in the show, as I said earlier. But right now, a guest who's been on our show before in a couple of different capacities that I don't think he realized he was not prepared to do, but thank God he's a BioWave analyst as well as a tax accountant and lawyer. Jeff DiCarlo was on the show, I believe, last week talking about writing off things that make him feel good to make him a better member of society. And because of his activist views and his revolutionary standpoint, I think he's sort of a go-to guy with stuff like this, because Jeff DiCarlo is out on the streets at the protests here in Los Angeles. Am I right, Jeff?
Actually, you're partly right. I am protesting, but I'm doing it in my own way.
Uh-huh.
Mark.
How are you doing that, Jeff?
Well, I'm staying inside today. I'm boycotting work today to show solidarity with the immigrant population and people that sympathize with them. I feel that's one of the strongest ways that I can do that is to not participate in this, paradigm.
But yeah, I understand that. So you're just sitting at home. I mean, shouldn't it seems to me that the way to do it is just to go on outside and go down the street downtown and get into the fray a little bit, don't you think, Jeff? Am I wrong?
Well, that takes effort, and today is about not contributing effort to the part of the problem, which, in my mind, the problem is, you know, the system, this classist system that keeps people oppressed, and
right.
I'm refusing to take part in that today.
Okay, so you're basically.
In fact, I'm probably going to continue. I'm going to refuse to take part in it for the rest of the week.
Really, you're just going to sit down and not exert any effort whatsoever to the capitalist machine.
Exactly, passive resistance. Absolutely, active passive resistance.
But that seems like as very little to do with the immigrant issue to me. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, it just sounds like you're just taking a week off work.
You are wrong. You are wrong because I feel that I'm being very powerful. I mean, one of the greatest revolutionaries of all time, John Lennon, is my inspiration. I'm staying in bed today. I'm not getting up. I'm not participating in effort. To me, is a term coined by the capitalist system.
Effort. Okay. Well, let me just get back to the premise here that today is a protest day for people who are demanding citizenship and rights as Americans. I don't think it's so much just about not working. Am I wrong?
Well, you said a whole lot of words there. I'm boiling it down to not working. You know, if our message wants to be reached, to reach people, we have to keep it very simple.
All right. So now you're honoring John Lennon. Are you there with an Asian woman?
No. I don't have a woman in my life. That's
okay. All right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring it up.
Okay. That's my bio waves gun.
Did you? Oh, yeah.
Meter right now. They're going way down.
Oh, so your bio waves.
No, that's okay.
Now, have you been out at all? Have you done anything? Did you at least go out and take a walk outside to see if there's any protests going on or anything?
Well, you know, I did. I have been affected by this protest also. You know, I'm a victim. I went to get a burrito at my local shop, and that was closed. And, you know, that's part of my routine. That's part of my day. That threw me off. I wasn't able to do that.
But did you feel proud of your brothers, though, out there, you know, saying, you know, shutting down work, you know, to go out and protest by not making the burritos for you?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Okay, Jeff. So you're going to be in bed the whole week. Maybe we should check back with you in a couple of days to see how your protest is going, what effect it's having.
That would be great. If you could send somebody over with some pizza or something like that, that would be great. I am not leaving the house.
All right, I'll make sure the world knows, and I thank you for being sort of an impromptu correspondent who helped us out today.
Absolutely. Hey, and I don't know if you guys have any kind of compensation or anything like that, but I could use a ride to. I have to go visit my mom this weekend.
Where does she live, Jeff?
She lives just in San Diego.
All right, we'll try and work that out. We'll try and get you pizza and maybe Jim's brother or somebody.
Wait a minute. You're laying in bed all week, and you're eating pizza in bed, and you want us to give you a free ride to San Diego?
Well, I think it's important. I would rather be eating a burrito, but I'm not able to do that because of this movement that's taking place.
So out of honor for that, out of honoring for the movement, you're going to eat pizza and have someone drive you to San Diego.
Sure, that's a good way to say it, yeah.
All right, Jeff. Thanks a lot. You have a good day relaxing.
Okay, fight's a good fight.
Yeah, I will, man. That was Jeff DiCarlo, tax accountant, BioWave analyst. We'll be back with Scott Ritter and more. Stephen Colbert clips as well.
And now he's got a gas crisis. Mark Maron.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You're the vegetarian. You seem to have that a little more than I do. Yeah.
I've learned to cook my beans with fennel seeds.
Does that really work?
And ferment them in a manner that has been handed down through the ages.
Does that really work? Fennel seeds? It doesn't really, right?
I have no idea. I haven't tried that yet. But, you know, I read that.
I think I found it for you. I dug it up on the internet for you. I went on the internet and I found it.
Going to try it.
I did. I you know, that's because I care about you and I'm working in a studio with you. It affects me. It affects me, Jim. Your gas situation.
I never let things loose here in the studio. That's
your
job.
Oh, no. You know, I watched The Sopranos the other night, and here's where my brain has gone the last 2 weeks of The Sopranos episode. You know, when Vito goes in there and the guy goes, you want to try the Johnny Cakes? They're cornmeal pancakes. It was a great episode. But for 2 weeks now, I've been obsessed with making Johnny Cakes and how to make Johnny Cakes. Because I like to cook, and I do it compulsively. And I like to cook pancakes for my wife. She likes spelt pancake because she can't eat the wheat. And after 2 weeks of searching, I actually found a Johnny Cakes recipe that's awesome. You like cornmeal stuff? You like cornbread?
Yeah.
Man, you know where I found it? On the Aunt Jemima website, of all places.
Really?
Yeah, and I adapted it from the Aunt Jemima website. They're like griddle cakes. They're almost like cornbread, though. Awesome. That's what I got out of that. I've now learned the one thing I gleaned from the recent Sopranos episodes is that I never tried a Johnny Cake, and now I've got a pretty good recipe for a Johnny Cake. Does that make me gay?
No. But, you know, asking, hey, would you like a Johnny Cake is like asking, hey, you know, your friend of Dorothy.
Uh-huh. Or, hey, nice Johnny Cakes, mister. That's kind of weird, especially if you're not in a breakfast establishment and there's no food around anyway. That's weird. Speaking of comedic elements, yes. Stephen Colbert, who we had on the other show, who I've known for years, we're not close friends, but we certainly know each other. I remember back in the day when he was on a sketch show on Comedy Central called Exit 57, I believe was the name of the show, and I was producing a short attention span theater in the same building, same office next to them. They were having fun with the sketches, and I was throwing to, you know, movie clips. Nonetheless, I've known him for a long time. He was on Morning Sedition, and his star is certainly on the rise. And certainly, you know, when we first talked to him on Morning Sedition a few months ago when the Colbert Show just started, he was having a hard time holding the character when he had people as guests on because he wanted to talk to them as himself. But I'll tell you, the character certainly solidified at the press correspondents' dinner the other night and galvanized in some beautiful satire that took some real guts, because he's standing there, and I know, like, we were talking about it when we were watching it today, you and I, Jim, and you said that it's, you know, it's a pretty warm room, but I think he went right to the edge, and there was certainly, it was not, I know Imus tanked at this thing, because he's not funny. Franken has done it, and he was pretty funny, and I believe Ray Romano did it, but he was not doing this type of jokes, but Colbert went up there and really cut into Bush in a way that Bush might have had to take a few minutes to figure out he was being torn a new one. And he cut into policy as well. And this first joke, I thought, was the direct attack on the way that Bush makes decisions. Can we hear that, Bill?
My name is Stephen Colbert, and tonight it is my privilege to celebrate this president. Because we're not so different, he and I. We both get it. Guys like us, we're not some brainiacs on the nerd patrol. We're not members of the Factinista. We go straight from the gut. Right, sir? That's where the truth lies. Right down here in the gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your gut than you have in your head? You can look it up. Now I know some of you are going to say I did look it up, and that's not true. That's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, look it up in your gut. I did. My gut tells me that's how our nervous system works. Every night on my show, The Colbert Report, I speak straight from the gut, okay? I give people the truth unfiltered by rational argument. I call it the no-fact zone. Fox News, I hold a copyright on that term.
And he was the big closer, man. And that's a tough place to have. And all the press was reporting that the big hit of the show was that doofus who did the Bush impression next to Bush, which was, it was okay. I found but it was pretty lighthearted and just played off on his malapropism. Is that how you say it? Malaprop?
Yeah. People love impressions.
Right, they do. But, you know, what was interesting is to see him standing next to him that, you know, his charisma, if he had any, if you believe that the president has any, was dwarfed to the fact where it was clear someone told him that he needs to play along with this. He needs to be humanized in this way. But I think it's an indication of how the media works, that they would lock on to that performance over Colbert's. I know a lot of the people who are listening to this show probably have picked up Colbert's performance either on C-SPAN or on the internet, but I think it's important to get it out there a bit, because I think that it really, in the climate that we live in, especially as a progressive or as a liberal, there's a certain element of fear of reprisal from this type of administration. And I think for someone to do what he did, looking the guy right in the face, was great. And this thing about polls, I thought, really kicked him in the pants.
Most of all, I believe in this president. Now, I know there's some polls out there saying that this man has a 32% approval rating. But guys like us, we don't pay attention to the polls. We know that polls are just a collection of statistics that reflect what people are thinking in reality. And reality has a well-known liberal bias.
And then he went on to do this analogy about the glass. Can we hear that? Is that on here? Bill, I believe it's the next cut.
Sir, pay no attention to the people who say the glass is half empty. Because 32% means it's two-thirds empty. There's still some liquid in that glass, is my point. But I wouldn't drink it. Last third is usually backwash. Okay.
See, he went on to do some other stuff. We obviously can't play the entire cut for you, but I don't even know if Bush was intuitive enough to know just how deeply he was being torn a new one. Colbert also went on to talk about Valerie Plame. He went on to talk about John McCain and the generals. He said this about Christianity. Can we hear that one now, the Christianity one? I believe is number three.
And though I am a committed Christian, I believe that everyone has the right to their own religion, be you Hindu, Jewish, or Muslim. I believe there are infinite paths to accepting Jesus Christ as your personal savior.
I just thought it was great. And you watched it, Jim. My first thought was, I often wonder when I see people stand up and do stuff like that, just what they're going through and what his brain must have been saying and how into character he had to get. I mean, that's a big room and the president sitting right there, and he was in a very sophisticated way just tearing him a new one.
Well, you know, and he's in a character, so that makes he's got a shield on there a little bit, you know.
I guess.
He's in character, and this is a great chance for him, too. I mean, when is he going to get another chance to do that to the president a few feet away?
I know.
With, you know.
And apparently, I read some accounts, the president and the first lady there, Laura, were really, as it went on, progressively more uncomfortable.
Of course.
Dissatisfied.
They're not that dumb. I mean, you know, Bush knows exactly what's going on there, and I think he's just playing along, just like he danced the Macarena, you know, in 2000.
But you could definitely
to look human, you know?
Yeah, you could definitely see it was getting at him. And that comment that Colbert made about small government and just about how you know, he's a proponent of small government, and that's why he small government that doesn't get involved, and that's why he I'm paraphrasing and ruining his joke, is why he thinks that Iraq is working well. Also, he said this about just in terms of where we are today, 3 years to the day when George Bush landed on the deck of that military vessel. He said this at the Correspondents' Dinner, Stephen Colbert.
I stand by this man because he stands for things. Not only for things, he stands on things. Things like aircraft carriers and rubble and recently flooded city squares. And that sends a strong message that no matter what happens to America, she will always rebound with the most powerfully staged photo ops in the world.
Uncomfortable laughter.
I don't know why the hell that thing isn't broadcast everywhere. I don't know why they wouldn't show that. Why do we have to go digging for that? That would seem like it should be broadcast television. I don't know what the beginning of the show looked like.
I'm sure it'll be on his show, or clips of it at least, or on Stewart's show.
And then he did a video of his audition for press secretary, which, you know, at just, you know, I don't want to be critical, but I thought it went on a little long. But it was funny. Helen Thomas was in it.
I didn't see
that one. It was definitely funny.
Bill Maher had one similar to that, but it was very short and concise.
I heard Bill Maher stole one of my jokes. I don't think they steal the jokes.
I don't think so.
No, of course not. He didn't steal the jokes, and it was a joke that could have been done, but I did it over a year ago.
No, since this is May 1st, I think it's a good thing to bring up the point that, you know, these people, Maher and Colbert,
uh-huh,
and Stewart, you know, are very, very funny people in their own right, but they also have great writers. You know?
Yeah.
Who make them look great.
Right.
On wherever they go.
That's the job of the writer in the entertainment business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the unrecognized, you know, role of the
I don't know. Writer. I think that generally writers a lot of times get paid pretty damn well.
Treated like crap.
Get paid pretty damn well.
No, they aren't.
Sure they are.
No, you're out of your mind. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, but that is absolute horse crap, especially in this business, in the Comedy Central in general.
All right, so you're saying that by union busting and working for a basic cable outlet that you expect a better treatment, but the writers I know that write network television are some of the best taken care of people in show business.
Network, yeah. I mean, Comedy Central, that was all non-union at The Daily Show.
It's still non-union.
It still is.
Yeah.
Know?
But I think that he does have great writers. They all have. They do have great writers. But I think, you know, Colbert, more so than either of them, I think because his show is just starting, and I know that at the beginning, in the first couple of months, he was working with one or maybe two people. He's a fairly sophisticated guy that has, you know, still in that point, in that phase of his career, because he doesn't come from stand-up, where I think he's generating a lot of his own content. Whereas I think that John and Bill primarily have been going at it long enough that they have guys that can effectively write for their voice. So I guess I'm just giving Colbert a few extra points on that.
Well, maybe so, but he's got a field of writers there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's got
from the Daily Show,
he's got
too.
A couple of Daily Show guys that you used to work with.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what exactly has happened in the last 3 years since Mission Accomplished, and then we're going to have Roberta Grossman in here to talk about Homeland, a documentary film about Native American struggles that definitely have a resonance with the progressive environmental movement.
And now, ooh, that smell. Mark Maron.
That was a Lynyrd Skynyrd reference, man.
Yeah, man.
That was a Lynyrd Skynyrd reference. And you know what's sad? I know the album. And not only do I know the album, I had the original cover before the plane crash. I had the cover with the flames on it that some people were like, dude, and they died. We got to change the cover. So look, it is 3 years to the day that George Bush stood on the deck of that ship with the Mission Accomplished banner, climbing out of the cockpit of that plane, acting like he flew the damn thing, in his outfit with largely inflated jockstrap apparatus to connote the power, the phallic power of this impotent president. What has happened? Well, I'll tell you, in the last 3 years, obviously, this last month, 70 American soldiers were killed. Countless numbers, always countless numbers of Iraqi civilians dead. But this has been the most violent month this year. And 2,400 soldiers have died since the beginning of the war, 2,261 of which have occurred since he stood on that boat in front of that sign. That's most of them. In April 2003, the Bush administration was confronting cost estimates of about $20 billion a year for Iraq. Today, the cost is approximated at $320 billion for the war effort. That's we're coming in at about $10 billion a month for this thing. Where's that money going? It's just draining.
He's a little off. He's like a contractor.
Yeah, they also got away with billions of dollars in contracts in that country for work that wasn't done. 3 years ago, 75% of the American public approved of Bush's handling of Iraq. Now, only 37% do, and half of them are retarded. Can I say that? I hate to use the word. How about delusional, if anything? He's got that base, man. He's got that 30 to 37, 38% base of people that as long as he stays stubborn and committed to policy that is impractical and evil, they will stand by him. That's the denial crowd, the evil ignorance bunch, the people that just believe you stick by it, the people that say, hey, you know, these tree-hugging hippies and this global warming thing is ridiculous. I really think that they just are belligerent in their attitude, and they just don't care. They just assume, well, if the world goes, we're all going, so I don't care. Yeah, I don't understand the thinking on it. Well, here's some other stuff in terms of obviously a lot of information is coming out in the last 3 years about why we invaded Iraq. It was based on false pretenses. It was based on cherry-picked intelligence. They bullied the CIA to give them what they wanted. People like Colin Powell are coming out over the weekend saying that he had advised them to put more troops in there. People in the CIA are saying that it wasn't their issue. It wasn't their fault. It was Cheney and company who coerced, almost really threatened the information out of the intelligence community. It wasn't an intelligence breakdown. I mean, there's proof now that the CIA's former top official in Europe, this guy Tyler Drumheller, revealed that Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and others within that White House Iraq group were told in a meeting in the fall of 2002 that a high-level intelligence source within Saddam Hussein's inner circle confirmed that Iraq did not have any active program for weapons of mass destruction. The bottom line is that the neocon death cult, because of the Pax Americana put in place in 1995, had this on their plate from the beginning. And I believe they still feel that they are going in the right direction. When we talk to Scott Ritter, I'm going to get into some of this stuff with him. And now, the bottom line is that when we went in there, Bush said that was basically that he was concerned that there not only was that false talking point that Cheney committed to for years about the connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda, but there was a concern on behalf of the administration that Iraq would become a terrorist haven. And now, 3 years into this war, 4 years into the war, he has made it that. And the estimates right now, the latest report from the National Center, the National Counterterrorism Center, said that there have been 11,000 terror attacks around the world last year, resulting in 14,600 deaths. That is four times the amount of terror attacks than last year. All right, 3,500 of them were in Iraq, and they accounted for about 8,330 deaths. But the indication is that this administration is not only losing the war on terror, but have created a terrorist manufacturing plant with Iraq that literally international jihadists travel there to use our soldiers as target practice, to use the insurgency and the many factions of the insurgency to train, plan, learn how to strategize, that because of this administration, they have guaranteed that the war on terror will be almost eternal. I can't wait to talk to Scott Ritter about this stuff, because he will definitely give you the real scoop. I mean, this guy, he worked for the CIA. He was a Marine. He was an advisor on a missile advisor during the first Gulf War. He was a UN weapons inspector. So he is going to certainly give us a lowdown on what's really happening. And the sad thing is that now we're so many years into it, 3 years after mission accomplished, and only 19% of the Iraqis today have working sewer connections. And that's down to, you know, from, that's down from 24% before the war. And also there's the issue of these contractors. Hardly anything is being built that they said was going to be built. And there's $20 billion or so missing. People have just cashed in. And no matter what happens in terms of whether or not we get rid of this administration, whether or not they're all put in jail, they still made out like bandits. Fortunes were made. Fortunes were made that will last well, you know, into the next 100, 200 years if the planet is around that long. And I think on some level they just don't care. In terms of what we've had conversations about climate, we've had conversations, environmental conversations, certainly with you, revolving mm-hmm. around meat and other things. But the film that Roberta Grossman made, which is Homeland: Four Portraits of Native Action, is a very interesting approach to the environmental issues that face progressives and face, you know, the people of the world, in that it focuses on four stories revolving around grassroots activism in several different Native American communities. It's a profound film because it really shows people taking action on a legal level, on a community level, to stop the horrendous corporate interests like oil, gas, paper mills, and uranium from taking action in their communities, from starting to pillage their communities again in some respects. We'll talk to Roberta Grossman after this. She's the director of Homeland. So stay with us for that, and Scott Ritter later in the show.
Live from Burbank, California, where whales come to strand themselves, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's a big bucket of chum. Mark Maron.
Thanks. Well, you're back on it. You're back on the writing the intro thing.
Man, you know, I spent a lot of time writing these.
That one was creative and drew from current events, and then it got weird at the end. That's kind of the formula, right?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Folks, with the Bush administration dismantling what few environmental protections there are left, America is starting to wake up to the reality of global warming. But there are other ongoing environmental issues that Native American communities have been dealing with for years. The film Homeland, Four Portraits of Native Action, follows the efforts of four activists in different tribes fighting different battles. All of them relate directly to the future of those tribes, but also to the future of the planet. The film's director, Roberta Grossman, joins us today in the studio. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So before we get into the conversation, I've got a link to the website for the film. People want to get hold of the film because this is one of those types of films that is really designed to educate. And there's a lot of documentary work that's coming out like that, and it's important. And Katahdin, the Katahdin Foundation, is the production outlet of the film. What does that foundation do?
The Katahdin Foundation.
I screwed it up again.
No, that's quite okay. The Katahdin Foundation was formed about 3 years ago to make this film, mm-hmm. and the goal of the foundation is to tell stories that might otherwise not get told.
And
to
I
make
think
films that you said to Ed that are intended to educate, but I would think that in the case of Homeland, that the intention is to infuriate.
Right. It is infuriating, and it is. But I think educate in the way that it gives hope that you can, that grassroots activism is still possible. It's still effective, and it can work if people come together and focus on the one thing that they are trying to get done. It seems that in the progressive community, you can't get 12 progressives together without some sort of argument ensuing about what's more important or what needs to be done, and things don't get done as well as they should.
I think in these cases in these communities, it's not that there's a lack of strife or infighting, but for these activists, they're very, very focused on what they're trying to achieve, and what they're trying to achieve is the survival of their people.
Well, let's start then. Let's start with the first story in the film, which is Gail Snow of the Cheyenne of Montana, and this is against the coal and natural gas mining interests, which they've been fighting for a very long time, since the 70s, I guess.
It was so interesting. Her name is Gail Small, and what was so interesting about her...
I'm screwing that up everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's okay. All right. The thing that was so remarkable about Gail and the other activists in the film is the level of dedication, the kind of obstacles that I think that would put me to bed permanently, I think put her to bed from time to time, and then she gets up and keeps on fighting. The Northern Cheyenne Reservation has been likened to the Saudi Arabia of the United States because it's underlaid with just, I can't remember now the exact estimate, but coal, clean burning coal, that's worth somewhere around $3 billion.
Yeah.
So that they've for 30 years, ever since, especially since the gas shortages of the 70s, 60s and 70s, they've been basically holding at bay energy companies that have wanted to come in and strip mine the coal.
And it's interesting that I found in the film was that these communities of Native Americans who grew up with these corporate workers who were there with the gas companies, who were forced to go to school with them and be treated like second-class citizens and be spoken down to, created a type of contempt and motivation for Gail Small to redefine her community. And some of the successes she had, which I found were fascinating, was building a high school for almost exclusively Indians to go to, strengthening the community around their traditional standards, and actually having some success in holding these corporate interests at bay.
I think that Gail comes from a very strong place, which is her traditions and her culture and her sense of connectedness to the place and to her people. So you really can't separate out the Northern Cheyenne from the place where they live. And not to overgeneralize about Native American nations, there are some 500 of them, there used to be more. But there's this through line that you cannot disconnect a culture of the Native American cultures from the places where people live. So what Gail always talks about is that they're not fighting an environmental fight, they're fighting a cultural fight. They're fighting for the survival of their people, for the survival of their language, of their ways of life. So that's a position of strength. And I think that the problems that she had growing up with the coal workers that she had to go to school with, I think that was an obstacle. I don't think that was a motivator. I think that's something she had to overcome. I think the motivation comes from a more spiritual and positive place in terms of wanting to preserve her culture.
Not just it's weird because I always identify a progressive movement for myself with resentment and spite and anger, and I guess that wasn't really there, but I just felt that there was a kind of emotional satisfaction when I was watching it to see that she could deliver a school to her community where they wouldn't have to be treated like that.
I don't think there's any lack of resentment and spite and anger among on Native American reservations.
Yeah.
But I think that was a really positive thing. It's just mentioned in the film, the fact that she spearheaded this campaign to raise millions of dollars to build the school.
Yeah.
And I love that through line in her story from the problems she had as a young girl going to school to being instrumental in bringing this high school to her community. That is very emblematic of me, of the kind of really powerful person that she is, in a very positive way.
The other theme throughout the entire thing was I couldn't help but get the feeling that you were watching the people that really had the birthright and the traditional right to be the stewards of the environment of this country. That because of their traditional connection to the earth and the way their spirituality works, I really got that feeling that these people, the Native Americans that you depicted, should be in charge of environmental policy on some level.
At least on their own lands.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, most Native Americans are fighting to be in charge of
the EPA,
though I'm sure they wouldn't mind.
Right.
But at least in their own waterways and their own land to have, you know, sovereignty is used when a corporation or the government wants to dump nuclear waste, but then sovereignty is ignored when a tribe doesn't want to have strip mining on the reservation. So there's, you know, it's a very cynical use of sovereignty.
That story killed me. Because I learned stuff in the story about the Navajo Nation that I really didn't realize. I didn't know just how many uranium mines there were in this country at that time, and that they were sending these people down into these holes with no protection whatsoever, no toilet paper, no drinking water. And they were literally, when that guy said that he was using uranium ore as toilet paper, I was like, oh my God, that is nuts. And now for three generations they've had cancer and horror, and now these uranium miners want to come back in and do it again.
Well, the frustrating thing is that the government knew. I mean, there had been German uranium miners before that who had died in droves from uranium-induced, you know, respiratory diseases. So the government knew and chose to ignore it. So it's not a very subtle kind of discrimination, and you're right, that the thing that's outrageous is then that 20 years later, 30 years later, the government would be on the side of a company that wants to come back in and do uranium mining, even though now it's a different kind of uranium mining.
The safe uranium mining,
right? It's like having like a good kind of leukemia.
Exactly. And then you have, that was also the interesting thing when you're talking about the schisms and the community resentment, is that I guess in the Navajo Nation, there are Navajos that own much of the land, and these uranium, this company that was buying the rights to mine on the land of individuals within the tribe, so that caused sort of a divide and conquer element within the tribes where they sort of fought each other for a little while, but it seemed like that Mitchell and Rita Capitan were having some success in turning the tide of how the tribe saw this.
Yeah, it's been very, very brutal for them. They've been cut off from their family and friends, in part, but people who stood to get money from the uranium mining couldn't understand why their cousins or their neighbors were putting a wrench in the works. For Rita Mitchell, was pretty simple. If this uranium mining and C2 leach mining literally leaches the uranium off the rocks, and the danger is that it will contaminate the aquifer in that area. And then there won't be any drinking water for 15,000 people in their town of Crown Point. So they thought it was a pretty simple matter of preserving
the future,
the community, the future of the water.
Yeah.
But it was very divisive because, because the people are poor in the reservations. I mean, that's an old story, but one that doesn't get told very much. You go into a reservation and the poverty there is striking. And so when a company comes in and offers millions of dollars, it's what Gail Small calls economic blackmail. I mean, I was thinking about the numbers you were talking about of the money we're spending in Iraq. How about just a Peace Corps or a Marshall Plan for the reservations?
Sure.
With a fraction of that money could do so much good.
I see the way that the administration, the way these business interests see these people, because when you look at the number of the communities, when you look at the third story, the Gwich'in Indians in the Arctic, who rely on this porcupine caribou herd, this is a small community of people. And what you really start to realize is that's what makes it so human in its scope, is you're looking at this beautiful, pristine wilderness, and this is a community that really relies on these animals, but it's only like 15,000 people, and you can just see an administration like this one or the corporate interests just working that into their bottom line, saying, who the hell cares about 15,000 people? And it's sad. Our guest is Roberta Grossman. We're going to continue talking about the film Homeland, Four Portraits of Native Action in just a minute, so stay with us.
And now he's got the belly fat blues, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim Earle. Our guest is Roberta Grossman. The movie is Homeland, Four Portraits of Native Action. You can link to it on the site if you want to get a copy. In the story I just brought up before the break of the Gwich'in Indians in the Arctic, the chief is a very young man. I think the youngest chief in the history of the tribe. And we were just talking about the numbers. And you see how small this community really is, and they talk about having relied on this one herd of caribou for 10,000 years. It's in the traditions. And you just know that people like the Environmental Protection Agency, like people within the Bush administration, like people within the oil companies, they don't care about these people. And what you show in your film is just how beautiful it really is, how beautiful these people are, and how important they are to the planet.
You know, it's a story that you could tell 10,000 times starting 400 mm-hmm. years ago, and this is just an ongoing story. I produced a series called 500 Nations that was directed by a guy named Jack Lustig, and it was creation 1890, and it was a series of stories about, you know, conflict between Native Americans and white people that came in. But the bottom line is, whenever we want something, it's very easy to push the Indians aside and say, well, they're standing in the way of progress, or they're standing in the way of industrial revolution, or they're standing in the way of the resources that we need to continue, living as we do. It's just an ongoing story. So the Gwich'in just happened to have held on to their culture for a lot longer because of their remoteness. And so the story is being played out right now. We can't say, well, the Indian Wars are something that happened a long time ago. Don't complain about that. That's such old news. It's not old news. It's happening right now. It's happening to the Gwich'in right now.
And what was going through my head, which is interesting, is that I may not visit up there. I may never go to the Arctic Refuge. I may never go to Montana to see the Cheyenne Reservation and see this beautiful landscape. But in my heart, I know that it has to be maintained, and their culture has to be maintained, you know, just in terms of what it represents to saving the planet. I mean, this isn't just about Indians. The stories that you're capturing reveal something that we should all be concerned about as people. And it's not just about beauty either. It's really about respecting the planet we live on for the future of all mankind, or womankind, everybody, people in general.
Well, you know, it's almost cliche. Mm-hmm. The environmental movement drew on Native American philosophy at the very beginning. Remember the Native American, the generic Native American in his canoe with a tear running down his eyes, and the famous PSA.
Iron Ice Cody, I think, was
right,
his name. Right,
yeah. with the trash floating all around him.
Yeah.
So Native American, the image of Native Americans was used to awaken Americans to our own, the inheritance of the beauty here in this country. But in the meantime, the Native Americans face the greatest environmental threats, most on the ground, of anybody in the country, pretty much. I mean, when we started doing the film, we thought there were a handful of stories, and we realized that nearly every reservation in the country faced grave environmental threats, so grave that they threatened the actual survival of these nations. Mm. So it's interesting that Barry Dana, for example, who's the former Penobscot
in Maine. I got to tell you, on a humorous note, it was great to see Indians speaking with a Maine accent.
Oh, yeah,
I
that's
really
great.
Enjoyed that.
That's really good. I know. They sound like, you know, John Kennedy.
How are you? Yeah.
He says that he still believes, he feels strongly that Native Americans still hold some the knowledge and the traditions that can be, maybe some kind of hope for the future, some path to guide us.
And I think that's true. And I think that the way he used the sovereignty, I don't know what you would call it, just that the government, the tribal government, and pitted it against the federal government in order to facilitate some action around that paper mill, even though he was not successful initially, you realize the place that these people were supposed to have in this country, you know, after they were, you know, leveled the first time, and how that is completely disrespected.
Well, that's the reason why I wanted to make this film is there is a sense that if you look at the map of the United States and you can just see how Native American lands just get shrunk down to these teeny little islands of land, and then still, now they're still being attacked for what's, you know, for what's under them, for the resources, and still being still under siege. To me, that seemed just wrong.
You can get the film if you go to the link on my site at markmarin.com. Now pronounce it. I don't want to mispronounce
Katahdin Productions.
The Katahdin Productions. And also, you're working on some other stuff. I don't want to give any more away about this film because I think you should see it. It's a beautiful film. What is the project you got going now? Because it's sort of a departure from Indian, from Native American stuff, for sure.
Well, it's just another genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Just a fun-loving gal who likes to go from one genocide to another. I'm making a documentary called Blessed is the Match, and it's about a young woman who lost her life in the Holocaust, but she was safe in Palestine, and she parachuted behind enemy lines in an effort to try to warn the Hungarian Jewish community about what was about to befall them. And it was the only outside rescue mission. It was 32 young people that were living in what was then Palestine. It was the only outside rescue mission for Jews during the Holocaust.
I think I read the story in Hebrew school. What was
I'm
the
sure
woman's name?
Hannah Senesh.
Yeah, I had to go. I gotta have to go back and reread now. and find out exactly what that story was. Because I remember being informed about it at some point in my life.
It's an incredible story. I mean, she's a national heroine in Israel, but not that well known outside.
Uh-huh.
But, what is the connection between Hanna Senesh and Gail Small or any of these people? And to me, and for the Katahdin Foundation, it's to, you know, ask the question, what can one person do? We're so overwhelmed by the monolithic power of Bush and Halliburton, and the forces that are, you know, arrayed against us seem so impossible to confront. I mean, we'll think about what Hanna Senesh facing the Nazis must have felt. So I think that if you tell sometimes stories of hope and struggle that
courage
that it can be inspiring.
Yeah, and I think
going forward.
Another one of the great enemies is that we all may be well intended, but we're completely self-involved. And to get out of that and to actually get selfish and take those kind of actions, it takes a real departure from the type of living we're accustomed to and encouraged to do in this country. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Roberta Grossman. It was a great conversation, and I highly recommend the film, and good luck with the next one.
Great. Thanks so much.
You bet. We'll be back with Scott Ritter. More heavy information.
Now, is he hurting his own cause with this sock puppet thing? Mark Maron.
Yeah, maybe. Folks, welcome back to the show. Go to markmaron.com if you want. Check out what's going on there. I'm going to be at the UCB Theater this Friday. Could use your help down there. Come on down and see the show. It's just going to be me. There's not going to be any intrusion. It's going to be pure Mark from beginning to finish, about an hour of it. Come on down, UCB Theater. Upright Citizens Brigade Theater is .com. There's a link to it on the site somewhere. I got to get it back up there. It's on my calendar section. You may have read Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story, The Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam Hussein. You might have read Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and the Bushwhacking of America. Or you might have read War in Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. Or Endgame, Solving the Iraq Problem Once and for All. Scott Ritter is the author, and he has been many things. He was a Marine. He was a ballistic missiles advisor during the first Gulf War. He was a UN weapons inspector in Iraq. Now he's one of the most outspoken critics of the Bush administration, their foreign policy. He's the author of all those books I mentioned, and he's with us on the phone right now. How are you, Scott Ritter?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
I'm glad you're with us. Now let's get right into it. Now I've read that you've said that the Bush administration, or the neocon death cult, as I call them, signed on to the bombing of Iran in the middle of 2005. Is that true?
Well, actually, what I've said is that the president, and this has been reported by the media accurately, the president in October of 2004 met with Pentagon officials and his national security team and instructed the Pentagon to be prepared to initiate sustained aerial bombardment of Iran by June 2005. That doesn't mean that they're going to start bombing. It means they have all preparations in place so that if the president ordered it, the bombing could begin. These orders were carried out, but for a variety of reasons, the political alignment of events that needed to occur to bring about the conditions conducive for bombing, didn't happen. And so the president is still working hard to create the conditions favorable to the initiation of military action. But yeah,
okay.
The president
this
administration is committed to regime change in Iran, and key element of making that happen is a sustained aerial bombardment campaign.
Okay, so let's get around to those elements that need to line up for him to instigate this thing. First, before we get there, though, with your intuition, do you think an attack is imminent, and has it already begun? I've heard some reports that the Pentagon is instigating tribal and terrorist attacks to foment aggression within Iran with terrorist groups that they have turned out. Do you have any indication that that is true?
Yeah, look, the Pentagon the United States is already at war with Iran. Most Americans don't recognize it as such because, A, Congress hasn't declared a state of war, and, B, it's not a large-scale conventional war. But war doesn't have to be, massive armies in the field. We have warlike activities taking place now. One, again, is the intent of the Bush administration. which is regime change, and that is an inherently warlike activity. We're basically saying that we have no regard for a sovereign state's status, we have no regard for international law, and that we will seek to achieve regime change. That is our policy. The Bush administration is committed to this policy, both in writing and in terms of the rhetoric they put forward, too. We've acted on it by carrying out a series of intelligence gathering exercises that involve not only the overflight of a sovereign nation's airspace. Imagine if Cuba started flying aircraft into the United States, taking pictures of places that it said it was going to bomb. We'd shoot them down. We'd call it an act of war. We'd have every right to defend ourselves. But we feel that we have the inherent right to overfly Iranian airspace. We've also sent in not just U.S. Paramilitary operatives and special operations forces to carry out special reconnaissance missions, but we've employed proxies such as the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the MEK,
right.
Continue to be listed on the State Department's watch list as a terrorist organization. They're now working for the CIA. They go across the border into Iran from bases in Iraq, and they blow up bridges, they assassinate political figures, and they collect intelligence. This is war.
Right.
We are waging war as we speak, and I do believe that unless something dramatic occurs here domestically in the United States, war with Iran, outright war, conventional war, is inevitable.
So in terms of what you're talking about, what could happen domestically, either the changing of the House of Representatives or the Senate enough to begin impeachment proceedings, or what do you see as a change domestically that could stop this from happening?
Well, I wouldn't take it to impeachment. That would be an ideal, but sometimes the ideals aren't realistic. I would settle for, at a minimum, the Democrats winning over the House of Representatives, not because I'm an endorser of the Democratic Party's platform. I think it's despicable. I find the Democratic Party in many ways guilty of the same warlike rhetoric that the Republican Party has engaged in. But when we talk about the United States of America, that which defines it, the Constitution, and the system of governance that the Constitution endorses, we speak of checks and balances. And right now we have a Republican-controlled House, a Republican-controlled Senate, and a Republican-controlled presidency, some would say Republican-controlled Supreme Court as well, that has a massive dereliction of duty when it comes to respecting the independent characteristic of each of these entities I just laid out.
Absolutely.
The Republican Party basically streamlines, so that we have an imperial presidency without checks and balances. I would like to see the Democrats win the House because at a minimum it will create friction that may slow down this rush for war. Another thing that's occurring is that the price of oil, the rising price of oil, has actually awoken elements within big business and the Republican Party. We had last week Senator Dick Lugar, a Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, say it's time to cool it on Iran. Not because he's suddenly, born again regarding, the evils of war or American foreign policy, but his big business sponsors are saying that if we invade Iran, the price of oil will go skyrocketing and their business interests can't survive. So there's a number of factors at play here,
right,
which independently or together may slow down the rush to war.
Even if they don't go to war, it seems to me that if Iran turns off the spigot, that they can jack the oil prices up overnight.
Well, and that's one of the points that Lugar made, is that we may not be the sole people occupying the driver's seat here.
That's right.
We may actually have somebody else in the driver's seat, and they're pointing the cart in the opposite direction, so we need to be very careful here.
Right, and what you're talking about, I think, obviously, is we have no support from the EU3, from France, Germany, and England on any of this, and I don't even like using the collective we, but more importantly, Iran provides China and Russia with a tremendous amount of oil.
And don't forget India.
Mm-hmm.
One of the points I raise over and over again is that the United States, although the largest consumer of oil in the world per capita, isn't the only consumer of oil in the world. We have Europe and Japan that consumes a tremendous amount of oil, and we have India and China, the two largest developing economies in the world that are dependent upon a sustainable, predictable flow of oil. And with all this competition out there, with an oil market that has finite resources with very little production reserve capacity, if Iranian oil is pulled off the market, either by Iran shutting off the spigots or by the spigots being shut off by American military action, we suddenly don't have enough oil to feed this global economic machine, and the competition that will ensue will drive the price of oil through the roof. And as, again, last week in an emergency summit meeting, the heads of the economic leaders of the G7 got together and said, if oil continues to be sustained at these high prices, the global economy itself is at risk.
And also, it seems to me that that's not too many steps away from instigating something that may look like a new Cold War with either with Russia again and with China.
Well, I think that that's inevitable. I think the issue of oil is, you know, here's the United States again promoting the notion of free markets, et cetera, but we only support free markets insofar as it benefits the United States. When there's true free markets out there, and we have other people competing for resources that the United States thinks it has the sole prerogative on determining, you know, who gets what and when, you know, it will lead to an eventual polarization of the world between the haves and the have-nots. And given the abysmal performance of the United States vis-a-vis the rest of the world, our ignoring of international law, the fact that we believe that 300 million people who call themselves Americans have the inherent right to dictate the terms of coexistence with the several billion other people around the world, you know, it's not just going to be polarization, but there's not going to be too many people on our side of the line. We've irritated everybody.
Right. Our guest is Scott Ritter, the former U.N. weapons inspector and a very prolific author and outspoken critic of the Bush administration. Now, let's talk about, if we can, in a few minutes here, how is the tension with Iran affecting the political climate of Iraq in terms of the Shia-dominated parliament and the spiritual leadership in Iraq, which is directly aligned with the Iranian government? How is that unfolding?
Well, one of the things I've pointed out is thanks to George W. Bush, we've allowed Iran to win the Iran-Iraq war. If you go back to the 1980s, there was a life and death struggle between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and the Islamic Republic of Iran, headed by the Ayatollah Khomeini and the mullahs. And again, Americans have a short attention span, but history shows that the United States allied itself with Saddam Hussein, not because we supported his dictatorship, but because we recognized that he led Iraq, which at that time was a secular bulwark against the expansion of anti-American Islamic fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thanks to George W. Bush, we've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein's secular bulwark, and in its place, we've allowed the Iranians to do what they wanted to do all along, install a pro-Iranian Shia theocracy that is inherently anti-American. A lot of Americans who simply tune into Fox News or listen to what the White House has to say, you know, go, hey, wait a minute, the Iraqis are happy that we got rid of Saddam Hussein, therefore they're pro-American. No, they're happy we got rid of Saddam Hussein. And right now they're not causing too many problems because they're in the final phases of solidifying their position on power. But they're not pro-America. The government of Iraq today is an extension of an Islamic theocracy in Iran that, thanks to irresponsible behavior on both sides, Iranian and America, but especially the United States on a global level, it's a government that's inherently hostile to the United States of America. So we're basically continuing to shoot ourselves in the foot on a daily basis in Iraq. And tragically, it's not politicians that pay the price, but the over 2,400 Americans and tens of thousands of Iraqis who have died and the untold thousands who have been crippled and maimed because of this war.
Our guest is Scott Ritter. And, you know, I have a couple of pretty important questions I want to ask you. Can you stay with us over a break real quick?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
Now, no drugs and no guns. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. We're back on the phone with us is Scott Ritter. He is the former UN weapons inspector from Iraq, who is a prolific author and outspoken critic of the Bush administration. And we're talking about Iran. We're talking about Iraq. And I just need some confirmation from somebody who's been on the ground in these places and knows what's going on. Is the plan, in terms of the neocon agenda, isn't their plan, despite the fact that that we have hundreds of, and we have thousands of Americans being killed, thousands upon thousands of Iraqis being killed, completely destabilizing the world in terms of terrorism. Aren't they looking at it that all of those things are really just a speed bump to them putting up this fortress of an embassy, putting up this series of bases there that they just see are going to be there no matter what the hell happens there? Aren't they just looking at all this as just, you know, par for the course?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of Americans today, when we're taking a look at the Middle East, take a look at Iraq, and we see a nation on fire. And some people say, well, you know, well, we need to slow down this policy or else that fire is going to spread. And I think most rational players who look at the Middle East and look at our intervention in Iraq recognize that we basically set this nation on fire.
Yeah.
The Bush administration has a completely opposite point of view. From their perspective, the Middle East is already on fire. The whole thing's ablaze. That's why they have a policy of regional transformation that encompasses not just Iraq, but Iran, Syria, and every other nation in the region other than Israel. And so their perspective is that they're trying to put out this fire. So they're starting with Iraq, and then they're going to move on and such. And so they already recognize, or they, what they're saying is, look, we know Iraq's a mess. The whole region's a mess, and we're not going to fix it till we take care of the whole the whole geographical area.
So no matter what happens in terms of Iran right now, or even in terms of what's going on in Iraq, their vision is that once they get the fortress set up there as an embassy and these bases in Iraq, once they get that spigot open and operating, they can take they can almost wait. They can push Iran aside. They can guarantee Israel protection, and then they could begin to take their time on some level.
That's right. Well, this is a process that once initiated won't be stopped.
And
that's what Americans need to understand. We can't view Iraq and the mess in Iraq in isolation. See, we sit here and say, this is a disaster. We need to talk about withdrawal. Even when the Bush administration says withdrawal, they're not talking about withdrawal and quitting. They're saying we're going to reduce the number of troops from 150,000 to maybe 100,000 or 80,000. But we're never getting out of Iraq because Iraq is the new fortress that we're going to use as a springboard to move on to Iran and elsewhere.
But it's a gamble, isn't it, Scott? I mean, in the future, who the hell knows what happens with global politics? If we continue the course that we're on and Iran continues to rattle their sabers, and if we start taking actions, there's no saying that Russia won't start supporting someone who's against us there in an active way. There's no saying, ultimately, that China will get behind someone who's fighting against us in the future, is there?
Well, actually, I would say that if we continue to behave in this fashion, we all but guarantee that Russia and China and India will not only align themselves together, but will actively support forces around the world that can contain and curtail irresponsible American activity.
Yeah.
So I think that we can pretty much make it inevitable. But, you know, the irony of this is that most Americans just don't get the following. You know, the Bush administration spoke of the global war on terror and talked about the need to invade Iraq because it was part of this terrorist front. Well, there was no terrorism, anti-American terrorism in Iraq till we invaded. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now we have the Bush administration talking about the need to confront China, not just Iran. China.
Crazy.
And what's going to happen, thanks to these policies that the Bush administration is implementing, is that we will alienate China to the point that China does become hostile to the United States, thereby becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right now, China's not a threat to us. China's not hostile to us.
They own us.
But we're going to make it. Oh, they and others own us, yes.
Now, okay, now in the last couple minutes here, is a draft imminent?
No. I think a draft is not imminent. I think a draft... both Republicans and Democrats recognize how wildly unpopular politically that would be on the domestic front. And sadly, let's say the national security situation dictated a draft. Neither party would be the one who would want to take the lead on that issue. So again, the issue of the draft is being bandied about, by some for political purposes,
right,
but not for national security purposes.
All right, Scott Ritter, grim but honest. I appreciate you being candid and giving us your analysis of the situation.
Well, thank you very much.
You take care, man.
Okay.
Great. Now let's do some jokes. How would that be? Some jokes?
Grim but
wow.
Honest. Grim but honest.
Wow.
Joke.
A lot happened in the world, in the news today, and we here at the Mark Maron Show don't want you to be caught uninformed or off guard, so here's today's version, edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. Illegal immigrants and their allies gathered today in cities around the country for a planned national day of economic protest against immigration laws. In a show of support, thousands of lonely, homely singles showed up to offer support. Some even brought signs with slogans like, "Hey, hot stuff, there's a green card in my pants," and "If you'll cross the desert for a job, surely you can munch my box for citizenship." Did I have to say that? Munch my box? Anyways, after a four-day strategy workshop with international space officials and scientists, NASA officials said making money on the moon is an essential part of the U.S. plan for space exploration. We all know what the real money maker is going to be. Moon porn. There's the filthy jokes coming. Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards is reportedly recovering from a concussion in a New Zealand hospital after he fell out of a palm tree. There was a little bleeding, and as always, wherever a drop of Keith Richards' blood touches the earth, a heroin tree sprouts. That's today's Short Order News. Did I just say munch the box?
Yes, you did.
Wow.
Munch the box. We're going to have a link to that soundbite on the website, by the way.
I should read these jokes before I open my mouth. Hey, look, folks, tomorrow, Joseph Masco, author of the Nuclear Borderlands, the Manhattan Project in post-Cold War New Mexico, to talk about exactly the tests that are going to be going on in Nevada, what the repercussions of those tests and also the repercussions of actually nuking a country will be in this day and age. Iran, we're talking about. Greg Dooley, formerly of the Afghan Whigs, now with the Twilight Singers, has a new CD out and stories to share. It was taped in New Orleans shortly after Katrina. We'll talk to him. Maybe an Army recruiter I'm trying to get on the show to talk about their tactics. Good night, sheeple. That's a heavy Monday, man.